Welcome to the Intersecting Us podcast, where math and life intersect.
In today's podcast, the hosts discuss the power of math in human flourishing.
Well, Intersecting Us, sometimes we get into movies, sometimes we get into different literature. I thought today, as we're going to talk about power, that we might start off with a comic book. I don't, Stan Lee put into the in his comic books with all these heroes and superheroes that with great power comes great responsibility. And I think that's maybe a good segue into what this chapter by Francis Hsu in Mathematics for Human Flourishing about power is. Dave, you know, when you get into this, he talked about the fact that power often sounds like a bad word. And he got into the power of things and the power of people. But one thing he gets into in a lot of this chapter, which is really good for math geeks, is about 52 cards in a card deck. So why don't you tell us kind of why he did that with power and kind of what he was trying to get us to understand about the cards and how that deals with power and math.
Right. It is kind of odd because the question he started with was, if you take a 52 deck of cards and you shuffle them, how many different possible combinations are there? And so you could start off with, like, you know, ace of hearts, you know, jack of diamonds, king of spades, and yada, yada, yada. And how many different ways are there of arranging those 52 cards? And so I was a little surprised, like, okay, what does that have to do with power? And the way he phrased it was, as math people, we have the ability to answer those types of questions with an exact number. Whereas if you were not using math, you'd probably look at that and say, well, I'd have no idea like how to calculate it, but it seems like it's a large number. And it's like, I bet it's at least 10,000 and maybe it's a million. I mean, maybe it's even a billion. I mean, I don't know. Once you get that high, who knows what a million, a billion, there's just numbers after that. But, you know, it's like kind of getting up there to those bigger numbers that we think about. But as math people, we have not only the ability to answer the question, what then he ended up pushing was not just what is the answer, but how does it have meaning? And then so he added a second twist to the problem that was going to contextualize the question and give it meaning.
Yeah. And I think one of the things he did when he asked about the combinations that could be done with 52 cards, and most of us, I mean, my family played cards a lot growing up. We do it now, you know, we play different games with cards. And what he did, which I think I would make as an encouragement to people who say, well, I'm not that math oriented. You know, I'm listening to podcasts. I'm understanding some of it. He does such a good job of kind of, you don't have to know that much math to understand this book and get a lot out of it. He even shows you how it works. You know, yeah, the first card is 1 in 52, the next one's in 51. You get this factorial thing. He does such a good job of that. But tell us more about what he does with that, though, and the concepts that he does and the way math can help us understand the perspective of it.
Sure. So he said, rather than asking for the answer, he gave us three questions and we had to determine which number was bigger. And so first question was the number of stars in the universe. The second one was the number of seconds since the Big Bang, since the beginning of time. And then the third one was the question of what's the number of possible configurations of a deck of 52 cards? And so, you know, on one end, you're talking about the magnitude of the universe. So some space that's way out there that, you know, who knows how far things go, but we know there's like, you know, billions and billions and of stars out there. There's more than what we think we can count. And of course, from time, you can't go any further back of anything meaningful than the beginning of time, like 13.8 billion years ago is what he used. You know, that's a lot of years. The number of seconds that is, that seems to be, you know, mind-boggling large. And so of those three, which number is the largest?
Yeah, and I remember reading it. It's funny because you trick yourself, because when he did this, my first guess would have been the stars. Mm-hmm. But when he asked the question, I'm like, well, it's probably the 52 card thing, because right, why would he do this if it wasn't, you know, does become the answer, but it wasn't because it was intuitive.
Right. Yeah. And the thing was, it wasn't because it was close either. And so the numbers he gave, the smallest was the beginning of time. So we have only had 10 to the 18th power of seconds since the beginning of time. So that's 10 with 18 zeros, still a very big number. Number of stars in the universe, that's also 10 raised to the 23rd power. So we added five more zeros. So if you think about like going from maybe one and then five more zeros would be 100,000. So, yeah, you know, that type of magnitude, multiplicative. So that's a lot. But then the number of possible configurations of a deck of 52 cards, 10 raised to the 68th power.
Yeah.
That's, so if you, let's say you square something. So if I've got like 10 times 10, that's 100. The way I can figure out like how that much area that goes to is I take 10 to the first power and then times 10 to the first power and I add the exponents 1 plus 1 that equals 2. That's 10 squared. That's 100. So if you multiply a number by itself, like as like squaring it, like creating a square, what you do is you add the exponents or double the exponents. So if we think of, let's take the biggest one, the number of stars in the universe. So line those up in some sort of line one by one into this, you know, a line of 10 to the 23rd and then square that number. So go 10 to the 23rd and 45 or 90 degree angle, and then, you know, fill in all those dots to complete the square. So you've got 10 by 23rd and 10 by 23rd. So that's the number of stars are in 10 to the 46th. And we're still 46. We're still like about 22 zeros away from 10 to the 68.
It's almost exactly triple. I mean, it's one.
It's a cube. It's almost a cube. So that's how many more combinations there are, which seems totally crazy because we're only talking about 52 cards in a deck, and that's not very many, and we shuffle cards all the time. And so how in the world, you know, can that get to such of a large number with only 52 cards? And so that was a cool story.
I thought it was probably one of the coolest stories. I might use that in another because it's one of those things that I would think most people would get it wrong. You know, some people get it right because there's only three answers. But the way he put it a couple different ways, which I thought was really neat. So he said, if a deck of cards were shuffled once per second since the beginning of time, it would still be nowhere close to realizing all the possible configurations of cards. That is mind boggling, I think.
It is. Yeah. So that would be, let's see, that would be the beginning of time. That was 10 to the 18th. So it'd be 10 to the 18th.
So that's, yeah.
By 10 to the 68th. So, you know, that's one out of 10 to the 50th probability. I think that's what that would be.
Yeah, and it's so you wouldn't even be a third of them, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing. Yeah.
So he said that if you did that, the chances would be astronomically small that you would ever shuffle the deck in the exact same way two different times, you know, two times.
And you think about that with playing cards in Vegas and all this kind of stuff. It's kind of like, and they do like six, this is just 52 because they'll do like six deck shoots and then they shuffle them all up. So then all this would take, you know, you take it to the sixth pot, you know, it just gets amazing. And the other one he said was it just made my mind go, it was exceedingly likely that each time you shuffle a deck, that the resulting configuration has never happened before.
Right.
In any deck that's ever been shuffled. I mean, that's just, wow.
It is. That is crazy. Yeah,
When you say something about you make history every time you shuffle a deck.
You just made math history because you just created it. And you can like almost be as confident of that as, you know, one out of, you know, 10 to the 40th power. You know, it's like so likely that you will have a unique shuffle. That, you know, we can't guarantee it 100%, but it's as close as you could get to 100% without getting there. So that is cool. So next time you get out your deck of cards, you shuffle it, assuming you give it a good random shuffle, realize you just made math history.
Well, and if you think about the 10 to the 68th, I mean, that just comes from taking 52 times 51 times 50 mm-hmm. times 40 all the way down to one. I mean, that's how you get the number. And I'm sure it's probably a little bit rounded. Well, maybe it's not. I guess I'm kind of assuming it is. But so when it comes back to the whole concept of the chapter or the concept, so How is he applying that to power then?
Mm-hmm.
How does he use that?
Yeah, I think the idea is just when we learn math, we have the ability to solve things, to help humanity out. And, let's talk about actuaries. We learn things about, like, let's say, calculus. We learn things about finance. We learn things about exponential growth. We learn some things about money and compound interest. We learn some things about probability. We kind of throw all those different tools together. And those are just kind of like tools. Like, a carpenter would have a hammer, and they'd have like a table saw, and they'd have all these tools. But those are just tools. But all those tools come together to build a house. And so for an actuary, we're going to use all those tools to make predictions about the future. And, that gives the insurance company the power to issue a policy with confidence that they will be able to pay the claim when that benefit becomes due. And so that is for you and me, probably a very realistic example of how knowing math can give us power in order to make, the world a better world.
Well, and I think it makes, once you get into, as you said that, the change found the meter a little bit for me, the idea, it makes sense. You're starting to understand the world when you go through these mm-hmm. concepts. And I think that is where he hit that, the power. He kind of did separate it into two things. And now as I think about it, it's kind of a little bit of what we've been doing with a lot at Intersecting Us. It's the idea of you have the power to make stuff, which he called stuff making, mm-hmm. where you could go out and make a card table, to play cards on. You could make a deck of cards. You could make all kinds of different things, and you can make insurance policies and those types of things too. But then he talked about sense making, which we have the power to. Sense making describes the ability to understand the world and to make meaning. And so, I mean, that's almost a definition of philosophy. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not quite, but it is the idea of, it's not, we've talked about this before, back in the 20th century, early 20th century, you had great mathematical and scientific minds make stuff, and they had the power to make, they figured out how to split the atom. Mm-hmm. so that, I mean, and that's like, boom, that's really a lot of power. They had the power to make power.
Right.
But when it came to how to, the concepts of it and what's, you get down to the, well, what sense does it make to use this? I just mm-hmm. read that, again, math geek, you remember the decimals, but, 19.8% of all the power in our country, in America, comes from nuclear power plants, which is part of the math and science that we use to get that. Mm-hmm. But when it comes back to using it as a bomb, now you're back into sense making.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense to use that to the power to do that, to capture it so we can power our computers and our cell phones and our lights and our, for where we are now, it's pretty cold, for our heaters. But does it make sense to blow people up with it, and that's a why question and a meaning question and an understanding the world question. And I think that I didn't really think about that when I read that, but that is kind of more looking at it from more of a kind of a empirical way and a philosophical way. And he does a good job, as he's done through this whole book, of marrying those two in such a good way. But in his book, and you can maybe talk to this a little bit or go into the next thing. He did obviously put sense making, kind of back to your 52 card thing. Yeah, you can figure out the data, but going through it, using a different perspective, looking at it with stars and seconds, it gave it more meaning for them, and it mm-hmm. made more sense. And that power that comes from there is what he kind of does in the rest of the chapter.
One of my favorite stories on that some of our audience probably has heard, when Steve Jobs had mentioned that when they came out with a new iPod, that it was like putting 2,000 songs in your pocket. And so, it's all math. Most technology geeks would have talked about hard drive or space and gigabytes and whatever. And, Jobs had an amazing ability to contextualize it so it meant something to the customer. And we can all understand, wow, 2,000 songs in my pocket. That sounds really cool. And so that, but that is something that was given because someone did the math. You know, he wasn't just guessing, but he also thought about how to contextualize. And I think that is a skill that us actuaries and mathematicians can always grow into, is going from getting an answer to being able to contextualize it, especially if we're communicating that answer to non-math people who may not have the in-depth knowledge of the math. They're going to want to understand, why does this mean something? And that's a whole nother challenge, but one that hopefully us math people can learn to grow into and step up and develop.
Well, and I think, and eventually he gets into the use of power, which is kind of more of the of the meaning of it, because he uses the term creative power, which has to do with, I think he even said sacrifice, but helping other people flourishing, which the whole book is kind of about that, versus coercive power, which, and he gone to get some really good examples of coercive power. The one, and I probably shouldn't even try to say her name. I know her first name was Sophia.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I can try it. It's Kovalevskaya, but she lived in the late 1800s. A Russian mathematician, was known for some important theorems with the, I think it was partial differential equations and stuff. And but she was, because she was a woman, they wouldn't let her be in university. They wouldn't hire her, and even though professors were trying to, but what he's talking about is, you know, coercive power limits other people's ability to create meaning. And that's, he used that as, that was a great example. I don't know if you remember that one, but the idea of creative power helping other people and coercive power being kind of more self-centered is kind of the way he was putting it, I think.
Right. The part I found that I appreciated when he was talking about creative power in this chapter was the idea that we have as math people, the ability to make definitions. And we often don't think about that when we first start off in our math career, because everyone else is defining things for us. But as you develop in your career, you learn that, hey, we have the opportunity to define whatever we want. And so it may be just something as simple as if you're doing an algebra problem and you're giving a story and they, you know, they tell you all this information. And then you look at that and you say, okay, well, I'm going to let X be the distance between here and the house. And I'm going to let Y be the distance from the bottom of the house to the roof. And so you just define something. That was something that you had the power to do. And once you make that definition, which you have the power to do, well, then you are fixed and stuck into, you know, using that definition throughout the rest of the problem. And so you can't just, you know, invent every step of the way. When you invent a definition, you must be consistent in how that definition is used. So, but it's something that once you start on that, you tend to be a little shy on it. But as you get good at it, it's really a lot of fun. As they say, the world is your oyster, and you can just start defining anything you want. And so you find that there's tremendous power and creative power in doing the math.
Well, because ultimately you're looking at the deep meaning of it, not just, you know, it solving equations or whatever you want to call it. And I think that's, the meaning keeps coming back. I think he even talked about how a computer can do the stuff making, but it can't really do the sense making, you know, which kind of goes back to, boy, that's been a while that we had a podcast on artificial intelligence, you know, the idea, sentience, sapience, all that stuff. But the idea, it's kind of the same concept he was talking about here. A computer can do all kinds of, make all kinds of things. We're seeing that with ChatGPT and all these artificial intelligent algorithms and things, but they don't really know why they're doing it. There's no meaning. They're just zeros and ones is what it really comes down to. And I think that's where the human mind being able to ponder this stuff is always going to be better than an artificial, because of the ability to really understand what meaning is and not just results. And there's power in that. So I guess I just want to tell our audience, I think as intrinsic human beings with a mind and all this, that we are always going to be more powerful in that way, philosophically, and define mind things in math or any other discipline than any artificial mind would it be able to do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, the one thing that I was thinking about in this book that really didn't come out too much in this chapter, but it was the first thing I thought about with power. And so I'm going to ask you, Brian, if I say the word recycle, what comes to mind?
A blue bin. I mean, that you put your stuff in the, that's what we do here anyway. You throw your recyclables in a blue bin, and then it goes in a different spot.
And then the whole reason why you're doing that as opposed to a garbage would be so that the materials would get reused, right?
Right. You're trying to be good stewards of the
stewards and
or whatever.
You know, and we all kind of feel good about ourselves. We feel a little greener, you know, in our innermost self when we recycle things, and we just did Mother Nature, you know, a favor. So all that's good. But one thing that I think about all the time in math is that math has this incredible ability to recycle things. And what do I mean by that? So if we think about something that Albert Einstein said, the eighth wonder of the world, so this is power, is compound interest. You know, the idea is that, you know, if you understand compound interest and let it do the work for you, you can be, you know, wealthy. And that's why insurance companies make the money they do, is because, boy, do they understand compound interest. So there's definitely power in that. And compound interest simply just means you keep taking interest and reinvesting it and get more interest on the interest. So at its core, what it is a simple exponential process, whereas simple interest is a linear process. So if your money is growing an account at simple interest, you put $100 in and you don't touch it, it's just going to grow like a straight line. It'll go up, but just like a straight line, where compound interest will be an exponential curve, you know, then that takes off and soon gets really big. So that is, you know, the power of compound interest is leveraging the idea of exponential growth. Well, once you learn that, let's say now you jump over to music and you want to start learning how to work with octaves. Octaves in music is like on a piano key. You go from like one C to the next C. And what you learn in music, that the hertz that we use to represent each note increases exponentially for each octave. And so like one A may be like at 440, then the next A is double that at 880, then the next A is double that again at 1760. And the math for how the keys on a piano are organized is the exact same math as that we use in compound interest. There is like literally no difference between the two. And so once you learn how to use compound interest in the exponential process, you can recycle the exact same math and now apply it to music. And it just works. Like, why it works? Well, you know, that's a whole other question, but it does work. And in math, we do that all the time. And the more math you know, the more you have kind of like at your disposal of things you can recycle. And that is really something I find very cool, is when I'm working on something and out of the blue, not expecting it at all, I can all of a sudden use a new tool, a tool I've known for a long time, and then apply it to something that I wasn't expecting. And I've recycled something that, you know, was there. I didn't have to learn really anything new. I just had to make that connection. It's like, oh, that's what I need. I need to use this tool right here.
Well, and I think whether it's math, science, even philosophy, you tend to stand on the shoulders of other people. And, you know, we talk the Oilers of the world, the Socrates, the, you know, the different philosophers that are out there, the Einsteins, you go from there and go further. And that's kind of what he was hitting with create. This is the creative power. Probably people who came up with the idea of compound interest were not thinking about music, but the fact that they put that out there and showed how it was done and understood what was going, the meaning of it, somebody was able to take it. And that's when he gets into, what did he use the word? Amplification, I think it was. Mm-hmm. It was the idea that if you use math to serve others, that it has an amplification effect. And I think in that letter, if you haven't read the book, there's a, he's corresponding with a young gentleman, I think, I don't know how young he is, that's trying to learn math in prison. And he was talking about how in that letter, he was talking about how this guy was seeing how much math was used by scientists to get, you know, these flourishing things. And amplifying things. And I thought that was really cool that the creative power can, you know, can rescue and help and help millions flourish just because you were humble enough to kind of say, hey, I understand this, here it is, and the power that's there. But mm-hmm. I like the way, because he said that at the beginning, power is usually like an evil thing or a bad mm-hmm. thing. You know, mm-hmm. what's the old, I don't even know who said this. Is it Machiavelli? Somebody. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's what a lot of us look at power. But I think the way Sue's doing it is so much better. And the way math does it, it's so much better. The idea that when you do a math proof, that's for everybody to see. Mm-hmm. I mean, you publish it and then everybody can use it next, you know.
Right.
And I
right.
think that's the cool, that's the power we're looking for. Power didn't have mm-hmm. to be bad. It's what your end game is.
Right. And the gentleman you mentioned, his name is Chris. And I guess we haven't really talked too much about Chris because he's in every chapter and it's a truly remarkable story. But the idea is he's in prison and he developed this dialogue with the author Sue, and they would just talk about math. And Chris, you know, was there. I think he was in there for a felony. And he was in there for a long time, like 20 years, but he started picking up math in prison. And I don't think he mentioned it in this chapter, but he talked about in other chapters was that math has the ability to transform time and, you know, places and things like that. And so even though he's in prison, he's cut off from physical world of our society, he was still able to do math. And so math had this ability to give him power while he was in prison, because now his mind could grow and learn more math. And for him, he really, you know, learned a lot of subjects and was very motivated by it. And, you know, if I was in prison, that's probably what I'd be doing as well. And, you know, it just kind of gave him joy while he was in prison. So I think that's a cool story about the power of math, is it's not limited by race or culture or, you know, your wealth. It's really just what you are willing to put in and in to understand.
Yeah. And I think that Sue himself, and, you know, neither one of us have met him, but he seems like he's got that kind of altruistic idea of, you know, you're supposed to be putting other people's first, that virtue in everything mm-hmm. that he talks about. And he talks about it with power here too. He uses the difference between creative power, which is humble and sacrificial and other centered, versus coercive power, which is limited because it's only about yourself and one and looking at one particular thing and worrying more about you and holding it over people. Mm-hmm. And so I think he does a good job. And kind of what made me think of that is the fact that he's even taken time to talk to this guy. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, right. Sue, I think he gets some enjoyment out of it, but he's not getting anything out of this, any external goods by sure, right. You know. But I think he's getting some internal stuff, you know, he's getting, and that's right. what he really cares about, which kind of tells us why this book has been so intriguing for us to go through and look mm-hmm. at and read and discuss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, yeah. It's truly motivating for me. And there's so many aspects of it, of the story that motivates me. But certainly the story about Chris is, you know, a wonderful thing to chew on.
Yeah, I think it is. And I've been in prisons with people to teach them some things in the past, and it's a captive audience. But you don't do it to necessarily make yourself money or anything like that. You do it kind of like Sue's doing here, just to try to think about someone else and maybe to maybe see what they can do, even if they're behind bars for a while. They can still, they're still a human being that has intrinsic qualities, that gifts mm-hmm. that it's just neat to see him reaching out each end of each chapter with a letter and stuff. So, mm-hmm. so I do have a kind of an ending quote. Did you have anything you wanted to add as we kind of wrap up
here? Maybe I'll give one quick story because it's one that many math people have heard about. That is the proof of Fermat's last theorem. And basically Fermat had this idea of proving that if you have this equation, A to the N plus B to the N equals C to the N, that would be true for only integers 1 and 2, but not anything greater than 2. And so it's a big theorem that's out there, more like you've heard about them. But the idea was, you know, it's just a question about numbers. Integers is what it was about. And that was posed by Fermat, who lived about 400 years ago. And many of the great math people tried to solve it, couldn't get to it. And finally, in the 1990s, it was proved by a guy named Andrew Wiles. And what was interesting about it for this, for today, was how he proved it was he used something called elliptical curves. And they, you know, if we think about ellipses, we know they're curves. And so elliptical curves, we know is curves, it's continuous. And it seemed like it has nothing to do with integers, which was the essence of the problem. But he was able to prove something with elliptical curves that math people then were able to recycle that logic and say that that is also mathematically equivalent to proving Fermat's last theorem. And so Wiles gets proof credit for proving Fermat's last theorem, even though his solution, his proof, only had to do with elliptical curves. But you know, the math powers that be were able to connect the dots and say, yes, those are two different things from appearance wise, but mathematically they are one and the same. And wow, that is so cool.
Well, and it just shows you the power of understanding the meaning, you know, the stuff that you can, it's not the stuff that you make, it's the understanding that actually makes it. And the stuff comes from that. Yeah. So, well, I'm going to end up, this is on page 142. I just thought it was a word that you probably wouldn't use for a power that you don't think, but creative power is humble. I just thought that was such a cool, you know, and it puts others first, which is kind of almost a definition of humble to some extent. It seeks to unleash creativity in others. Coercive power would never do that. And I thought that was a good way to end it, that it's humble because it's sacrificial and it's trying to think of others first. So it's kind of back to the whole meaning of the book, Mathematics for Human Flourishing, the idea that you're not doing it. You're not the only human that's flourishing there. It's the other people that we're trying to get to flourish there. So as we continue through this book, we do really encourage you to get the book. Obviously, we think it's a very good book to read, whether you're just a little bit interested in math, but if you're interested in life, it will humble you. And in this chapter, it shows us how power does not have to be looked at as something that's evil, but can be something that looked at as good because it can help other people find their creative power and make their life flourish also.
This has been the Intersecting Us podcast. To further engage with Intersecting Us, go to intersectingus.com.